Hi, welcome to Space Scamps. Oh yeah, we're doing this again. This is normally a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and unqualified middle managers. I'm the future ghost of Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer and a Haunting of Hill House fan.
And I'm Mars Reed Lobato, and I am traveling through a black hole. And also, I'm a fan of the Christopher Lee folk horror musical film, The Wicker Man.
Each episode of Space Scamps, we watch three different episodes of Space 1999, and then we rank them on a big list of best to worst, which we've only just created for Space 1999, despite having already watched five episodes of it. But today, we bring you not only our list, but three more utterly bonkers episodes of Space 1999. I hope it never gets saner. Anyway, before...
I must be honest, I think I may have created a monster in introducing you to this show.
It's so much fun. Like, it's somewhere between, like, Event Horizon, Mothership, Space Horror, and Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. And I love that kind of place in between it all.
Like, I love how Space 1999 has that very sterile, hard SF 2001 A Space Odyssey, Star Trek the motion picture. Like, we're going to try and do this as realistically as possible. And they just meet fucking bonkers space madness.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, we've got three new slices of madness for you all today. But before we go on, Mars, what non-Space 1999 thing have you been enjoying?
Well, I've been watching a lot of Star Trek. No.
Oh, God.
I have finally finished a video game that you and I have mentioned on this show a lot, and that is Hideo Kojima's didactic masterpiece, Death Stranding.
Oh, good. You are the only other person I know who has completed it.
Oh, I know someone over here who has, I think, platinumed it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I saw the requirements and couldn't be bothered, but yeah, it's quite a game.
It took me 5 years just to finish the story. So I'm not going to try and 100% it.
No, I thought you were going to say to finish for closing cutscenes.
Oh, I finished the closing cutscenes. My God, I finished the closing cutscenes.
We were cooking dinner when you messaged me with that and ate it, and I went to bed and was like, should I message Mars, see if he's still going? But yeah, I just figured you were eternally, like, on the beach.
Like, I think Rihanna got home around about 4:45 p.m. And then the cutscenes, I think, finally finished right between 6:30 and 7. It was nearly okay. Dinner time. I think I was served my dinner while sitting on the floor watching Die Hardman give his impassioned monologue about why he's called Die Hardman.
And it's not just because he likes the films.
And it's not because he likes the film. And apparently, like, he did it all in one take in filming the cutscene. And apparently it was very emotional for all watching.
Of course.
And then, like, honestly, after like 2 hours of me just going, okay, wrap up. The last 2 minutes happens, and I'm a crying wreck.
Yeah.
And I think that's the magic of this game, and I'll be honest, do you know what inspired me to finish this game?
Oh?
The 10-minute trailer for Death Stranding 2.
Oh my God, that trailer.
Because
It looks so good.
I finally watched it, and I'm like, Rihanna, I have to finish this game so I can pre-order it. I can pre-order... Like, I don't pre-order new video games.
Yeah.
But I'm going to pre-order this one. I'm going to use my PTO to take time off work to wow. play Death Stranding 2. And I have no shame about this.
No. It's... I can't wait to see what on earth comes of it. So I saw that trailer and was like, I do not know. And yeah. I realized that was me with Death Stranding 1 as well. I'd not yet become invested in Sam Porter Bridges, the porter who builds bridges.
For the future.
For the future. And, of course, is the adopted son of the president as well.
Who is the bionic woman?
Who is the bionic woman, yes.
And his best mate is Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
We're not making any of this up.
No.
No.
No, it was a fascinating experience. I'm sure at some point when we next have a kind of Trek talk about trekking somewhere, we'll probably revisit Death Stranding for more of a conversation. See, about
are you going to pick it up on release day, or are you going to wait till it gets a bit cheaper?
It's probably going to be a rare release date.
Yeah, I think we'll probably record an episode shortly after the first week of us just destroying our lives and our relationships to Death Stranding. And then record an episode about just how we feel about,
yeah, like emotionally where we are with this game.
Pretty much. Like, this game provided a lot of emotional catharsis for me over the years, which is weird to say about a game where I can make Norman Reedus from The Walking Dead chug 5 cans of Monster Energy drink in like one sitting.
And then piss. Yeah, it's, as a game that was my lockdown game, it meant a lot to me, despite all of the Hideo Kojima of it, and often because of...
Yeah, look, there are very few games where you can have it throw a grenade containing your own pee, and have it make sense on a story level, and a gameplay mechanic level.
Yeah. Wow. So yes, God, that's end of June that's coming out as well. Not long.
Yeah, it's that's going to be the game I buy myself for my birthday, and then probably I will see Superman, and hopefully that'll be good.
Hopefully.
So, Charlie, what non-Space 1999 / Star Trek / Death Stranding activity have you been enjoying recently?
Well, it's been 10 years that Emma and I have been together, so for our anniversary we decided to go to Glasgow for a week, and it's pretty far up from where I'm at. You know, the only further down you can get really from where I'm based in Brighton is the Isle of Wight, where I was born, which is very much Innsmouth kind of vibes. But, we caught the sleeper train up and had a nice week away. I got to see a number of castles. Stirling Castle was really nice, and the hilliness of it, you know, it put into practice all of my training living in Brighton for so long. So that was good. There was an old jail, which, I didn't get put in, despite many apparent friends suggesting that be the case, Miles.
We only suggested because we love you.
Aha. We saw many game shops of generally like low to mid quality, and I just wish I could sit them all down and go, work together. You've got the Warhammer weirds. You've got space. You evidently want to be running a cafe instead. Combine powers. But yeah, it was nice seeing a few different places like that. Got to go to a distillery as well, so that was quite nice. I've got some whiskey from that to enjoy of an evening. And Glasgow, it's quite nice.
Yeah, so I've heard.
Yes, and despite being extremely southern, I didn't get knifed once.
That's good.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And only once tried a bad Scottish accent, but only Emma was there to hear it and reminded me, don't. Oh, God. And when we went to Loch Lomond, there was a dinosaur themed restaurant.
Awesome.
Jurassic Grill. It was great. It was all either families with little kids admiring the dinosaurs or giggling adults. Like, there was nothing else there. And
Charlie, did you try and climb a T-Rex?
No, we did have our lunch underneath the Dilophosaurus, and the manager of it, I assume manager, came out with a giant Triceratops hand puppet to speak to the little kids, and then came over to us to introduce the puppet as well. It's like, I'm trying to be polite, I'm trying not to crack up, but it is very difficult. So yeah, that was a nice time.
Good. I'm glad. I've not spent enough time in Scotland. Some old friends of mine live in Glasgow, so hopefully whenever we manage to make it back to England, we'll make a trip up ourselves.
Cool. Well, let's make a trip further and further away from Earth. As yes, we are once again boarding Moonbase Alpha.
In the far-flung future of 1999.
I know, it's so futuristic, but only if you think the 1970s kind of aesthetic is futuristic. And that your rank is designated by a single sleeve, which I didn't really pay attention to until this time, where it's like, oh, the sleeves mean things. Okay. But yes.
Clearly you've not watched enough Gerry Anderson shows.
No, apparently not. Bits of Thunderbirds. I'm sure some Stingray. And yeah. Oh, and Terrorhawks.
Yes. Terrorhawks.
We had some Terrorhawks action figures, and that was the only reason we saw the show. So yeah, these aren't quite fitting in with the Star Wars action figures that we had.
No. They might fit in with the Black Hole action figures.
Ah. Yes, God, there's something that's been on my to-watch list for ages. And as this year seems to be a science fiction year for me, I might actually get around to it.
Well, let me know what you think, because I do unironically love that film.
Well, we're not going to a black hole this time. We're going to a black sun. Yeah, what a segue. Although it is technically still a black hole, pretty much. We are going to episode 10 of Space 1999, titled Black Sun. It aired on the 6th of November 1975, written by David Weir, directed by Lee H. Katzin. The UK number one hit was Art Garfunkel with I Only Have Eyes For You, and the US had Elton John with Island Girl. I know I've heard better versions of I Only Have Eyes For You. I think every version of I Only Have Eyes For You has been a better one than this, but it's an all right song.
Yeah.
And Island Girl, not one of his best.
No, but it is nice after, like, you know, the amount of Ed Sheeran and we've had to listen to for this show. It is nice to hear Elton John sans Ed Sheeran.
Yes, that is true. I'm going to dress up warm for the freezing atmosphere as I get closer and closer to the black sun, and try to recap it in 5 whole minutes.
Okay, Charlie, I'm going to set the timer and got it. There's no fun like engage.
I know.
Okay. All right, Charlie, you have 5 minutes. Launch all eagles.
Black hole sun, won't you come and wash away the rain, black hole. I can't remember the rest of the lyrics. Anyway, Tanya's getting the coffees in for everyone, which is a recipe for disaster in a mostly white set when an asteroid erratically does a flyby of Moonbase Alpha. Why did it do that? Why? There's some kind of black sun, and it's pulling Moonbase Alpha towards it. One guy called Mike Ryan takes Eagle One out to check it out, and how black is it? None more black. He fires a laser at it, and the light is consumed. He gets pulled towards it, goes all wibbly, and then blows up. Sandra, who apparently has been seeing him, faints at that. Understandably, I guess. Victor starts drawing some maths on a wall, house style, and thinks the black sun's going to pull them apart in a few days. Koenig is understandably not thrilled. Kano says even computer, his best friend in all the moon, can't figure it out. Victor suggests maybe some kind of force field, and somehow has taken the time to make a diorama to show it off. Kano's upset because they'll have to divert power from computer. Koenig and Victor head outside to put the force field together and to kind of stand there while Alan shoots at them from afar. The force field works. Hooray, they don't die. This apparently is mostly for morale. They're still kind of fucked. And Koenig's sorting out a lifeboat, but doesn't want everyone to catch wind already. But bad news. Paul's found out there's only 6 hours left. Less than they thought. Victor gets electrocuted when one of the pylons from the force field blows up, but luckily his false heart saved him. And less than 4 hours remaining, the station's getting cold. Kano reckons the base won't survive without computer, but switches over to essential services only. Alan asks about Eagle 5 and the whole kind of lifeboat situation. He insists on being on it. And Koenig says, okay, only 6 people are going in. Alan, Sandra, Dr. Russell, and 3 no-names who I don't think we've seen before. They prepare to launch. Yeah, Paul says goodbye to Sandra. I'm guessing she's moved on pretty quickly. They take off. And yeah, it all looks a bit empty and cold on the moon base. Victor pops by to give Koenig a spacesuit to keep warm. Although he tries reassuring Koenig to go, our odds have been pretty lousy since the start, really. You know, I put the odds through the computer and it was like, you should be dead so many times over 10 episodes in, right? Victor also talks a bit about theology, not God necessarily, as a big science brain like he has, you know. It's more kind of cosmic intelligence that's hopefully out there. And he has a drink of brandy with Koenig, who toasts to everything that might have been. And Victor says to everything that was. And Paul mentions that he never thought it'd go out this way, which, yeah, fair. Yeah, people are all playing cards. Kano and Matthias are playing chess. Paul's alone playing his guitar until Tanya shows up. It's quite a nice, touching scene, as they're all probably doomed again. Koenig doesn't know what's going to happen with the Black Sun, but Victor hopes it will get interesting. And by interesting, do you mean weird? Because, yeah, it's going to get weird. The moon gets nearer and everyone goes translucent, as does the moon. The force field's holding. Is this the force field? Is this what you think force fields are? No, because even the evacuees are vanishing on Eagle 5. It's like a weird effect, like going through one of those kind of foil string curtain kind of things. And then they're old men, more old if you're Victor. And they're wandering through a kind of weird set, and they're realizing that everything is everything else, and the universe is living thought. Someone let Grant Morrison into the writing room. There's a voice talking to them. They ask if it's God, and the voice says it was good to know them. And after some more effects, they're out the other side. Hooray! Yeah, computer's working, no Black Sun, and they're on the other side of the whole universe. Wow. So yeah, that was fun.
All right. Okay, 6 seconds.
Nice. We got...
I feel like you forgot to mention one important plot point.
Oh?
Everyone on Eagle 5 also got teleported through the Black Sun ended out on the other side.
Space magic slash God slash cosmic intelligence. Also, they're all the way across the universe now, which that's even further from Earth now. That's like Voyager kind of thing.
I was watching this one with Rihanna, and like I was joking. There's in Hitchhikers, they talk about Milliways, and there's a long monologue about the restaurant and the end of the universe. And at each point of how the science works, the narrator goes, "This is of course impossible." And it's like the speeds that the moon should be traveling at to be traveling, but doing this, you know, traveling through distant solar systems and galaxies before being shot out at the other end of the universe is, of course, impossible. But, you know,
of course,
it's space 1999. You have to just kind of fucking wing it.
Oh, God. Yeah. Like I picked up the role playing game of this, and they pretty much say that about the science of it all. Of like, look, guys, we're not here for that.
We're not Traveller.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, God, they'd all be dead if it was Traveller.
I think they wouldn't have made it out of character creation.
But yeah, this kind of story, sometimes I see it done and I'm a bit like, oh, of course, everything they try is going to fail until the 11th hour, you know. And of course, that's the way drama works.
Yeah.
But sometimes it can get too much like that. Like, I think a number of Geoff Johns' big event comics have been that kind of, no matter what, everything will defeat them. There'll be no progression. There'll be nothing. It's just going to be increasingly bad. And the enemy is increasingly invulnerable to everything until somehow they hope and it's fine or something like that. But this, like the fact that they so cavalierly kill a lot of people, you go like, oh God, yeah. How many of them are going to make it out of this? You know? Cause yeah, in theory, there's a limited amount of people on the moon base.
Yeah. It's like with, the new modern Battlestar Galactica, where in the credits, they have the number of how many survivors. And that number does change on an episode-to-episode basis.
Yeah. But yeah, it was nice seeing a lot of this. Like, the moments of the people in the crew kind of knowing what's going on. And even up in Eagle 5 going like, kind of, oh, this is awkward. Everyone together fleeing with a load of supplies, knowing that everyone else will die.
I love that one moment when Koenig is announcing who gets to live. And one of them is just like this random person in a corridor surrounded by people. And then when her name gets mentioned, everyone just kind of leaves. And you're like, oh God, this is awkward.
Yeah. Oh dear.
Like, we've had episodes of Star Trek when the characters are in a situation where it is all hopeless. Like, what I'm kind of thinking of is where Silence has Lease.
Yes.
When they're stuck in the cosmic creature is literally just experimenting with them. But even that just never feels as hopeless, because you have Picard, like, engaging the self-destruct and just like, if we're going to die, we're going to die on our feet, like brave Americans. Whereas in Space 1999, it's like, we're fucked. Let's just have a drink and play cards until we get spaghettified.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like folks in a trench that know that death is coming for them, you know? Final game of cards, bit of brandy, maybe a cigarette, and then just all fucking die.
Yeah.
You know? I remember quite early on in reading RPG theory kind of stuff, I think it was Robin's Laws of Good GMing, where it was mentioned about the cultural difference between some different kind of countries and the way they run things. And that over here, it was a lot more, we have survived kind of thing, where America was a lot more gung ho. We're going over there. We're killing a bunch of monsters that are baddies and we're taking their stuff. And yeah, it was like, oh God. Yeah. Is this psychology going, like, something from both of us in wartime to then RPGs even? And you know, you can see with this, yeah, about like, well, we're fucked. Okay, like, the good news is from the episodes we've seen, they don't do that every time, because my word, they could have.
That would get, you know, very just pessimistic very quickly.
Yes. Yeah. And they do, like, they do still keep working, keep trying things. I liked Victor in this one. His sense of still attempting things and of curiosity. You know, he was that scientist who's going, well, it's going to be interesting going in this black sun. You know, it probably won't survive, but got a drink.
Got a drink, got a cigar. Meanwhile, Kano is just kind of sad about computer.
Oh my God.
And every time.
Every time. I did end up messaging you at one point. Kano, if you love computer so much, why don't you marry it? So I know he's got, like, Doug Ramsey stuff going on. with his connection with it. That's fine, but sometimes he can get a bit much with it.
Again, this does feel like a mood and a tone you wouldn't get on Star Trek.
Mm.
And especially, like, you know, Gene Roddenberry would never, with the benevolent cosmic intelligence, god, female-coded god as well, because the intelligence has a feminine voice.
Yeah, I was going to ask, does this ever come up again?
I don't think so.
Okay. Right. Because, yeah, that's one of those things where it's like,
Okay.
So there's some kind of cosmic, like, I don't know, is it like some kind of good cue or good kind of thing out there? But yeah.
It's not like Quantum Leap, where the more religious and theological angles of the show just become more apparent as the show continues, where the show's last episode is basically Sam Beckett effectively meets God, and God tells them, oh yeah, you could have gone home anytime you liked, but you valued helping people more than your own well-being.
Yeah, and we could use a guy like you.
Yeah. Gene Roddenberry would never.
No, God no. No, they'd have to defeat God somehow.
They'd have to punch him. Have to punch him with a bit of space rock. It's weird because, like, the entire thing of the episode is, like, midway through the episode, they just kind of give up and accept the inevitable.
Yeah.
And, like, I really like that. Like, it's, you know, you get, I'll be honest, you kind of get tired every so often of just seeing people being brave and noble. Like, I've always wanted to see is, you know, when, like, the first the 2009 Star Trek film, where Four, playing Kirk's dad, drives the Kelvin straight into the thing to his glorious sacrifice. Yeah. I really want to see a moment where someone is doing that and are like, I fucking hate this.
It's maybe give us some weasels, you know. Yeah. We'll see some weasel action with the next one of these, but yeah.
It's like David Tennant's last episode of The Tenth Doctor, The End of Time, where the Doctor realizes that he has saved the universe again, but he's still lost. He's still going to die, and he has that breakdown. And I'm like, I like this because it's real. Because it's not the noble sacrifice. It is our hero going, this isn't fair. I could just walk away and leave you to die. It's not fair. Why does this always happen to me? But then still turns around and gets in and does the right thing. But it's nice to see that moment where he's like, this fucking bites.
Yeah. Well, it's that, you know, that heroic quality that even though it's not fair, even though you don't want it to be happening to you, you do it anyway. You know, you do the thing. And, like, here there's less of that ability to do a thing. You know, they've got what their main attempts are, the force field.
And the lifeboat.
Mike Ryan firing at it, force field, lifeboat, and just dying, really, which it's only an hour episode. Apparently it was going to be 2 hours originally, but got cut down quite a bit for this. And it's like, I don't know if a second hour would have helped it.
No.
You know, like, especially where that weight would have been. Would it have been the despairing side? Would they have gone full 2001 with the end sequence? And gone like, yeah, this is why they're old men now that look kind of very caveman coded.
But the thing is with, like, a lot of hard science fiction, especially like 2001, Interstellar, is that even in these very kind of hard coded SF films, the resolution ends up being something almost like metaphysical,
yeah,
or magical. Like in Interstellar, like the big thing is, love transcends time. Hard SF is generally never as hard as people kind of go on about, because it just ends up being the metaphysics are so outside the scale of human ken that it's basically magic.
Yeah, here we get a bit of that. And the world of Space 1999 is one with fairly basic technology, fairly kind of like things do very much what they say on the tin. There aren't any kind of magic beam sort of things from Earth, but elsewhere, fuck knows.
Like, you don't just apply like tachyon emissions like in a Voyager.
Yeah. There's no kind of technobabble table or anything like that.
But there's a nice little model.
There is. I like that Victor made a nice little diorama.
Do you think it's properly to scale, or is it like not? Or is he had to rush it?
He had to rush it.
All right. So, where is this going to go on the space slate?
So, our space slate, freshly created, we have 5 whole entries on what will one day possibly be a list of best to worst from 1 to 48, because that's exactly how many episodes there are of Space 1999. Currently, our number one episode is Death's Other Dominion, where Brian Blessed fucking melts into a skeleton. Amazing. Our midpoint at number 3 is the Hellraiser weirdness of End of Eternity. And our lowest point is, surprisingly, the pilot. Because it's fun, but it's just not as insane as we would
know.
No. So, where should this go on our slate?
There's stuff I really like about it. There's a lot I like about this one. But, like, End of Eternity with the weird Hellraiser guy, I really like. I love Mission of the Daryans.
Yeah.
It's like watching what if the cast of the Enterprise went to, like, the bad dystopian space future?
Yeah, it felt in some ways like some of the horrific kind of cultures you might find in a Red Dwarf or something, where,
yeah,
you know, but serious.
Like, or like the first season of TNG, which feels like, from what we've watched, wants to kind of push the boundaries of like what you can get away with in on a TV budget and TV standards and practice. But where Star Trek just kind of inevitably sort of just has to compromise because it's much more of a family show.
And for me, like, I don't think it's better than Dragon's Domain. I love the weird tentacle monster in the spaceship graveyard.
So do you think it's better or worse than the End of Eternity?
I think it might be better. Okay. Like, the guy was entertainingly kind of dramatic, but at the same time, he could be a bit one note compared.
No, I will have to. I'm going to agree.
Cool. So that puts it at our new number 3. God, I've realized after all this time with Casual Trek, these are all going to be top 10 episodes. We'll have ranked 8 by the time this is done. Okay, good. So, our second episode for today is Space 1999, Season 1, Episode 14, titled Earthbound. This aired on the 4th of December, 1975, so it couldn't have been a reference to that video game.
No.
It was written by Anthony Terpeloff and directed by Charles Crichton. The UK number one hit was Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, and the US had Fly Robin Fly by Silver Convention. So, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah. Yeah, like, Fly Robin Fly was a good few seconds of music repeated constantly. But my word, the journey that Bohemian Rhapsody takes you down.
Bohemian Rhapsody is Bohemian Rhapsody.
It really is.
Like, you know, is it the greatest song of all time? It's up there. I mean, I'd say it's up there. I mean, but, like, it's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
I don't think you can be objective. I don't think you can be objective about Bohemian Rhapsody. You just can't. It's so iconic
it's for beyond a reason. That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was actually a great fun one to do on Rock Band as well. But yes, so Miles, I believe you're heading earthwards for 5 minutes. Oh, to actually get my timer ready. Think about that. Oh, not an hour and 5 minutes. So, God, that'd be terrible. Almost the other way of going, speak for as long as you can about one of these. But the plot must always move forwards. See if you can get two times for show length. No, you have 5 minutes to head to the Earth starting now.
It's space 1999, so what are they doing? They're having an office meeting. Simmons, who is a weasel little shit, who is Koenig's boss, but I don't know, I guess he's just been, like, just hanging around in his quarters doing sod all while, like, everything else is going on, is just like, yeah, we should try and get back to Earth. And Koenig is all, we're on the moon. We can't steer the moon. There's no point in trying to get back to Earth. We don't know where it is. We just have to hopefully find a new planet where we can settle. Simmons, even though all these guys are more like office workers and not like space adventurers, like Simmons is space middle management. This guy is he is like feeling completely useless, but he's still going to be a dick because, you know, he's going to try and micromanage this mission. They detect a weird spaceship, which looks like a blue ornamental vase, and it's flying towards Moonbase Alpha, and it starts changing course to land on the moon. Koenig selects a team, and they go over, and they find on board the spaceship this big chamber with all these big glass cases, which look kind of like the pastry cases they have at Starbucks. Which look like the kind of pastry cake, the kind of cases where Soviet leaders get put in state for when they have their funeral. And they're full of these weird long-haired people, except for one, which is filled with a bunch of burnt crumbs. Very much like a pastry case at Starbucks at the end of the shift. With some dicking around, they wake up. The people inside wake up, and they're a bunch of, like, weird people from the planet Kaldor, and their leader is called Xantor, who is played by Christopher, the man, the myth, the Charlemagne concept album singing legend Lee. It turns out that these guys are on their way to Earth. Huh. Weird. It turns out that it's on a kind of on an exploration mission. They're like, hey, so you're from Earth. Do you know if it's still around, if you're the moon? And Koenig's like, yeah, no clue, mate. And Simmons, finding out that there's a spaceship that can travel the vast distances of space with suspended animation. That's the important thing, because it's going to take this ship 75 years to make it to Earth. But the crew will be in cryosleep the entire time. And Simmons, you know, spirit of compromise and spirit of man, is all like, Koenig, could we nick the spaceship? Which Koenig is like, no, we're not nicking the spaceship. Go to your room. Turns out that the suspended animation cryosleep capsules do work on humans because they try on Dr. Russell. And so there is one free spot. One person on the crew can make their way back to Earth if they so choose. And how are they going to decide it? Is it going to be like, I don't know, a song contest? Or, I don't know, a jig? A dance contest? We're going to sort that with a Moonbase Alpha square dancing contest. Nope. They're going to plug the details into computer, and the computer's going to print out three names of the three people most qualified to get sent back to Earth. Simmons just kind of wheedles up to Koenig again and goes, look, my man, Koenig, I'm useless here. So do you mind if I knock off and go back to Earth with these guys? You know, I could go straight home, tell them about what's going on over here in 75 years time, and, you know, hopefully not die. And Koenig is like, whatever computer decides, we're going to go with. And Simmons treats this in a very mature, humane fashion by stealing a gun, stunning a bunch of people, and unplugging Moonbase Alpha. And basically threatens Koenig. Koenig, you're going to let me on that ship, or else we're all going to freeze to death. And Koenig's like, hey, that's not on. And Xantor turns up and goes, well, if he really wants to come along, let him come along. If it means that the rest of you survive and he plugs Moonbase Alpha back in, we'll take him with us. And Koenig reluctantly agrees.
Insufficient data available under prevailing circumstances.
Well, computer says time is up.
Why don't you marry computer?
Maybe I will. All right, carry on.
So while the computer is still working out the answer, Simmons escorts Xantor and the Kaldorians at gunpoint back onto their ship. He lets them all get in their cryo tubes first because he's just that nice. And then the ship takes off and starts flying back to Earth. And Simmons just gets into his cryo tube and just kind of curls up nicely, ready to sleep off the next 75 years. Simmons wakes up and he tries to contact Earth on his comm lock. And nothing happens. Earth's not picking up. But Moonbase Alpha is. Wait a second. How long has he been asleep? 10 minutes! Simmons tries to get out of the case, but he's stuck in the case. Turns out that they weren't able to properly reconfigure the matrix of the cryotube to make sure that Simmons will sleep through the next 75 years. Simmons gets to die very slowly and very deservedly, while Moonbase Alpha gets to hear him screaming for help, a help that'll never come, because the rest of the Kaldorians are going to be sleeping very nicely with a very nice surprise in 75 years. Koenig just kind of just turns off the communicator, and computer has printed out the name of the person it was going to recommend to send back to Earth, and the name was going to be Simmons. Simmons had just not been a douche, he might have got a free trip completely Earthbound.
Oh, the ironic death. 1 minute, 46 seconds. Far less than the time it would take to get to Earth. Oh my god, Simmons, what a weasel.
Okay, first of all, before we get to Simmons, do you know who I'm glad we now get to talk about? Because we were never going to get the chance to talk about him on this show. And also, much like Brian Blessed in our first Space Camps episode, we get to talk about Christopher Lee.
Oh, yes. The man, the legend. What a joy. What a joy to see, even though he is not the most enthused to be there.
No, like Brian Blessed gives us a magnificent performance. He hasn't gone full Flash Gordon ham yet. He's getting there. Mm. But Brian Blessed, he takes the material and he delivers. The moment he's earned his beer money within like his first line in this episode, Christopher Lee, you remember how we joke how in Encounter at Farpoint, whenever it does a close up of Patrick Stewart's face in that episode, you can see him mentally kissing his career goodbye?
Yeah.
Whenever it closes up on Christopher Lee, who is wearing a magnificent glam wig and some very ridiculous, like, eye nose makeup, you can see Christopher Lee just mentally going, so this is my career now. I was in The Wicker Man. I was the monster in the first Hammer Frankenstein film. I was fucking Dracula, bitches, and now I'm a space hippie.
Yeah, I mean, looking online, he did this because one of his daughters liked Gerry Anderson's work, so he agreed to do it, and even was like, fine, okay, like 2.5 days work on and off. And he hated the nose prosthetic thing that was made to kind of flatten his nose out and then apply you know, it looks like someone's put sun lotion in like a T shape on their head and not rubbed it in or anything. And yeah, apparently that makeup was also foul. So he was in a bad mood about that. And when they took some of it off, it took some of his nose off as well. So lovely.
But, you know, it's Christopher Lee, so he looks imposing. He's, you know, he has a fantastic voice.
Oh,
so
God, yeah.
Even if he is slightly phoning it in, he's still giving it stuff to work with.
Yeah, and the fun kind of twist of this being something where the aliens seem sinister, but actually, no, they're fine. They're just going on their way.
They're benevolent.
Yeah, just a bunch of space hippies. But it's Christopher Lee, and they are coding him very ominously, even with the very kind of hippie attire.
It's Christopher Lee. You know, you could have him be, I don't know, the well-meaning, fumbling dad in, like, a kid's film, and he'll still be the scariest thing in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, dear, did I do that?
Like, I recently rewatched the Hammer Hound of the Baskervilles movie, where Peter Cushing plays Holmes. And Christopher Lee, he plays the new Lord of the Baskervilles. So he essentially gets to play the romantic lead in this film. But you're still waiting for it to turn around and turn out that the guy who was meant to be almost being killed by the titular hound was in fact the villain all along, because it's Christopher Lee.
Yeah, like, how has he not done some murders?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So, yeah, because I think I mentioned what happened to Simmons in the previous episode. Because you're like, where is the Simmons guy? He's in the first episode, he wasn't in any of the others.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Simmons in Breakaway as a kind of a real piece of shit weasel character. And I was like, oh good, we've got one of these. And admittedly, like, logically, it would probably be overusing that to have him pop up in each of the episodes. Like the episode we just talked about, where was Simmons? They probably locked him in his room because he's going to try and do something really awful. But it was fun seeing him again. And I'd originally written in my notes, oh, Simmons, like, with his first appearance. And yeah, he just gets so much worse with all this. When I was laughing out loud when he was like, right, I'm nicking a gun, I'm getting out of here. So, oh no, mate, you are not going to be competent enough for this.
The thing is, he was. Like, he got away with it. Like even Xantor was just like, yeah, okay, all right, if it means that much to you, sure.
Yeah, seeing the amount of distraught people when all that happened, it's like, oh God, yes, we've had to capitulate to this guy, we've had to let him win. It's like, yes, but no one gets away safely here. I did also put in my notes when Simmons was first freaking out, and that when he was like, well, you might be in with a chance, depends what computer says. There, it's like, okay, if computer picks Simmons, it is only going to be because the moon base will be a lot safer without him there. And I still reckon that's going to have been the case.
Simmons is kind of like the David Brent of space. He's like, you usually get like bad admirals in Star Trek. You never get like a bad middle manager. You never get a bad boss.
Yeah. Yes, an assistant to the captain who, yeah, is just brilliantly unpleasant. And yeah, what a death as well.
I am sure this is up there on like traumatizing moments this show gave its younger audience. Because, like, I'll be honest, I've had nightmares about that, about dying that kind of way. Like, being buried alive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a pleasant fate. And luckily, it's not a pleasant person. if only he could have actually waited and, you know, done the tests. Because, yeah, apparently whatever they did with Dr. Russell wasn't going to be compatible with him.
Yeah. Or, like, because they rushed it, and, you know, because he basically did a hostage situation. It's like, hey, don't be a dick.
Yeah. And we... One of the other things I did notice, and it might just be a coincidence with this and the previous episode, Alan once again wants in on this on a way out. Now, I don't know. I've not seen enough to go, that is a character trait of him. Or if they just needed a person to go, can I get in on this whole leaving?
I think that's just one of those things. Like, it's one of the things I like about... And I'm sorry, because you're going to roll your eyes, because I'm going to bring up Blake 7. There we go. He rolled his eyes.
Roll as much as I can there. Yeah.
Like this is the thing that you get, again, I think it's that dichotomy of British sci-fi versus American sci-fi. Hmm. Where, like, you know, Star Trek, Stargate, Babylon 5, your heroes are going to be very sort of square-jawed and pulpy. Even if you develop them, even though if you give you kind of show the layers, like you give them like emotional problems or psychological problems or like addiction problems, the characters are still going to act in a particular way because, you know, it's part of the media. It's just part of the genre that you have a particular kind of hero, and anyone who is like, say, cowardly or a little bit, you know, a little more unscrupulous is going to get either dispatched pretty quickly or not be one of your main characters. Like, like the original Dan Dare. Like, Dan, you know, Dan Dare is square-jawed, stiff upper lip. He is best of British. And his sidekick, his Batman, is Digby, who is an overweight, lazy, like, guy from the north who just wants to have, like, a pint and fish and chips and not be on these daring space adventures. Like, he is the Sancho Panza to Dan Dare's Don Quixote.
Yeah.
And you have that in, like, Blake 7, you have the character Villa, who is this cowardly thief, and will always be, like, whatever happens, he's going to have an excuse to not go on the mission. He's always just going to want to stay on the ship and not get shot at. And you generally don't get that, like, in Star Trek. Like, everyone's ready to throw themselves on the grenade for the cause. Like, okay, and I think your closest is Quark, but Quark's not a member of Starfleet. He's a business owner.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess it'd be tricky with some of the roles. Like, maybe it'd have to be someone that's like a helmsman or something on an away mission that'd be like, yeah, I don't want to be part of this. Because, yeah, they'd send security most of the time, but...
So it's nice to have like a guy like Alan who's like, fuck this noise, I want to go home. Again, it doesn't, and like no one's like shaming him for it, because he's like, you know, if there's a chance to go home, I'll take it, please. I don't want to die. Like, I had a 5-year life plan, and the moon being knocked out of orbit by a massive fucking nuclear explosion has kind of put a dent in my 5-year plan. I was going to lose that weight. I was going to dye my hair. I was going to work on that novel. But no, I'm on the moon, hurtling through space.
And all my notes, they're back on Earth.
All my notes. Like, I didn't update my Scrivener before I left Earth.
Oh, no. Oh, that's terrible.
Like, I had flashcards. I had a board at home with all my chapter breakdowns. I was gonna learn ukulele. But no.
All we have is a sweet sitar.
Meanwhile, Simmons is just like, look, I'm not certified for this. I am certified to give health and safety talks and the fire safety training in the staff canteen, and I am completely out of my job description here.
Yeah, which he is. He very much is. Yeah. Okay, so as far as this one goes, where do we want to put Earthbound?
On the space slate. Oh, man. Oh, God. This one's hard. Because it's not like it's like a post story. Everything's just kind of working up to that final twist and the cliffhanger. Like, this is an Outer Limits episode ending, where it's like, oh, ooh, you get your ironic fate.
It's difficult, because Christopher Lee is a legend of a person, but again, he's not giving the performance for either Brian Blessed or John Shrapnel gave.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it might be, I don't know, it might actually be a bit lower on the list. I think it, as fun as it was, the death of the weasel.
The death of the weasel is the high point of the episode.
So, personally, this was very good fun, and I enjoyed the presence and death of the weasel. But I think this might end up going second from the bottom here. Like, it's still better than Breakaway, but you look at Mission of the Darians immediately above that and go, mutant, and like, yeah.
And also, it's kind of just fun to see these guys actually do a Star Trek. Like,
definitely.
And just kind of completely, you know, I would say I have one main complaint about these three episodes. Mm-hmm. We never get a point like we did so many times in the episodes we watched, where Koenig is just like, you're all weird, stop it! Like, I don't know if at this point Koenig has just embraced the madness, or, you know, like, Christopher Lee was just actually really nice.
But, yeah.
Yeah, so like, I do have to agree, it might be one up from Breakaway.
Yeah, okay. And yeah, I do wonder with Koenig, if it is that thing of actually his senses were on the money. Like, this one's fine. This one, I'm going to let be weird. It's all right. Compared to some of the others where it's like, really? This? Like, could you all stop it? It's too weird for me.
Thankfully, at no point did the Xantor go, oh yeah, so we've implemented a genetics program. Because that'd be the point where Koenig's like, nope, get off. We're done. We're done. Go.
Oh, I was waiting. I was waiting for that to happen.
You were waiting for the moment when Xantor says, of course, when we get to Earth, we're going to implement a breeding program and, you know, conduct some apocalypses.
Yes, we've got our ideas about eugenics. We're so close.
We've got a 5-year plan about selective breeding here. No!
No!
we were so close. So, yep. I'm down. That one's definitely one up from the bottom.
Yes, our third episode for the day is Space 1999, Season 1, Episode 22, titled The Troubled Spirit. This aired on the 5th of February, 1976. Written by Johnny Byrne, I assume no relation to John Byrne.
We did that gag last episode.
Oh shit! Sorry. Okay, ignore that. Nope. Directed by Ray Austin, no relation to Chuck Austin. There's a new one for you comic fans out there. Okay, the UK number one hit was ABBA with Mamma Mia, and the US had the Ohio Players with Love Roller Coaster, which I've never heard this version of.
I've only heard this song in the movie Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Yeah, yeah. I think
I think there it's done by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It is indeed, yes. That's when we got, like, MTV2 for a few years. That's where I heard it from. And yeah, it's not a million miles different. It's all right, but I don't know, it's that thing, much like with Silver Convention and Fly Robin Fly, it's like, okay, this feels a little samey, like, okay, it's run its course a bit after a while. And Mamma Mia, again, is one of those classics.
It's a classic.
Like, yeah, it feels like, yeah, it's not really here to be judged. Much like Bohemian Rhapsody, it's just not really doable anymore.
All right, do you know what is doable?
Why, what, Miles?
I'm talking about this episode of Space 1999 in 5 minutes or less. Yeah. Or in Charlie's case, 5 minutes or more.
Oh, yeah, probably.
All right. Charlie, do you have your sitar?
I have my sitar.
Okay, now commence sitaring.
Okay. So, there's a concert going on and someone's noodling on a sitar while the audience are frozen in a kind of pensive stare. Further away, in the habitation unit, looks like there's some kind of weird seance going on. Plants are shaking, readings are going nuts. Is this a The Happening? Miles, this had better not be a The Happening. Anyway, the concert gets interrupted by a strange wind, and the seance's leader, Matteo, is knocked out. Koenig comes in to check what's happened, and there's a Dr. Warren, who said that Matteo's been warned about his experiments, and Matteo's girlfriend, Laura, tries to defend his actions. It was a proper scientific seance, after all, primarily with the goal that Matteo had of figuring out a way to focus psychic energy from a group of people in order to speak to plants. Very normal stuff. Dr. Russell checks out Matteo and asks what happened. Matteo's mind was struggling and he couldn't resist something that was there. Matteo's distressed when Laura mentions that Dr. Warren's trying to take down his experiment, and even more when he sees a weird silhouette that kind of almost looks like him. Dr. Russell leaves Matteo alone to do some paperwork and gets startled when Matteo, but with a weird crispy face, shows up, scaring her, and then is gone. Dr. Warren is busily packing away the experiment, and Laura offers to take over. Is she going to? Well, yes, actually, and she and Matteo have a bit of an argument, and he loses it with her, and then freaks out when he sees his hand looking all crispy for a moment. Speaking of which, Dr. Warren also sees the crispy hand. It attacks him after some leafy noises distract him. Oh no, he's dead. The lads come round to investigate, and Matteo's insisting that he didn't do a murder. Victor, of course, has been recording his brain patterns, and Matteo was like, oh, didn't believe that could be done. Apparently so, and his brain's gone a bit weird. There has been some psychic phenomena around here, which Alan calls bullshitting. Victor does that whole erroneous, we don't use all of our brain, we use 18% of it kind of thing, and that he's willing to embrace that supernatural psychic events are going on. Not paranormal ones. Put a pin in that, Victor. Laura sees Matteo working feverishly and tries to stop him. She swipes a doohickey from his desk and he freaks out at her. And she runs off and Krusty Monster's there. Oh no! Koenig gets a call. Laura's dead from Crispy Monster. Matteo rightfully blames himself. Now, he wants to recreate the seance to bring this thing out into the open. They, all of the main cast and Matteo, concentrate and hold hands. Matteo starts shaking, and a crispy ghost version of him shows up. Oh my god, it used to be Matteo, and says the others took his life. But how can he be a ghost if Matteo's still alive? After a brief collapse, Dr. Russell gives Matteo a checkup and sees that he's in shock. Victor's excited that the ghost's here to avenge itself and suggests an exorcism. Matteo freaks out in a secure cell, which for some reason has weird burning force beams in place to keep people safe from the ghost. There's a big fight between Matteo and his ghost after they get separated by all his shaking. And the pair have a fight and eventually they collapse into the beam. The ghost fades and sure enough, Matteo is all crispy and burnt when they turn him over. Oh, the irony! It was his future ghost! Ooh! This could have been a Halloween episode, actually. Oh, well. The end.
Charlie?
Yeah?
42 seconds.
Hell yeah. I loved this.
Okay, two things. One, Gene Roddenberry would never have the characters on his show do a seance.
No, he wouldn't.
Two, this might be the most Halloween-y episode of a sci-fi show we have done, and we've done how many Halloween episodes by now?
Three, I think.
And like, yeah, this I think knocks them all to the side.
Oh my god. This was so much fun. Like, the sitar bit was weird at the start. Like, it sets you up in a slightly uneasy place with, what was the guy's name? Big Jim Sullivan playing on the sitar. And everyone kind of just staring, almost frozen.
I don't know. There are a few people. There was that one guy in the front who did like the old kind of yawn, put his hand around the girl sitting next to him. I think there are some holding hands like a few rows down. And then there's Koenig at the back just sitting there going, can I say this is weird yet?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few people that are just sat there kind of hand on chin pondering the sitar, which, yeah.
They had a little program as well.
Mm.
Like, they donated resources to making sure, like, that his recital got, like, properly promoted on Moonbase Alpha.
I've got to imagine they've got some very good recycling for things like that.
Oh, more than likely.
But yeah, Mateo was very good fun. As a conflicted person who was, like, going through some shit. Like, it was a weird experiment that he had going on of, like, yeah, I get that he was like, yeah, we need plants, we need to eat. And, you know, it's not mentioned, but they need them to breathe as well, probably. But maybe harnessing psychic powers isn't the way to cultivate your plants.
Mm.
Like, I'm not good at gardening, but I'm pretty sure that I can say focusing psychic energy at the plants won't make them better.
I mean, they say that talking to your plants helps, but, you know, talking to the plants with your mind, that could be it.
Well, yeah, I mean, with talking to plants, surely it's for carbon dioxide. Like, my old science teacher, Mr. Jafferji, always said to people when they were acting up in his class, I want you to apologize to my plants, because then it will be of some use.
Damn, Mr. Jafferji!
Yeah, what a burn! So, yeah, it was curious. Like, what other experiments are going on here?
Like,
they're letting this stuff go.
Man, like, it's like, you know, again, this is the stuff you wouldn't have on Star Trek. Because Star Trek would just take this too seriously. And like, too kind of realistically, in little bunny rabbit quotations.
Mm.
It would be experiments with tachyons. Or, yeah, like, a hyperphase conduit. It wouldn't be, let's be honest, Riker, Geordi, Worf, and Wesley Crusher sitting in engineering trying to do a seance.
Yeah, when, despite what Victor said in this, it was a ghost. Like, it was a weird future psychic ghost.
From the future.
Yes. Now, I love that kind of, when you get that sort of non-linear hauntings, like in Hill House and that, which it's like, oh, shit. Okay, the rules are really off and weird for this. Because, you know, whenever you have magic or psychic phenomena, I prefer it on the weirder side than this is, you know, a bunch of feats, you know, a bunch of skills and easy things to do. Make it weird.
Like, okay, you're familiar with the term liminal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that Moonbase Alpha is a liminal space?
I don't know. I think it's got a lot of them. But I don't know. I guess it is that sense of they are launched out from a home. They are looking for a home. They're trapped in a kind of odd, slightly purgatory-ish space. I don't know, maybe if you made a modern one, you could go, let's channel Severance and Control and those kind of things. Like, it wouldn't take much.
No.
That for it to bleed into that sort of thing. Or even, like, your Solaris and all that.
Oh, God, Solaris. hang on, which Solaris are we talking about? Are we talking about the Russian one or the George Clooney Soderbergh one?
I've only seen the original.
Okay. The Soderbergh-George Clooney one is okay. It's not as weird as the Tarkovsky film.
Yeah, See, I'd heard that and was like, yeah, give me the weird one.
Yeah. Again, some fantastic filmmaking in this one. Some fantastic camera work. Like, especially like the opening pan of the sitar and like the big horror moment when the lady is running down the corridor and the door at the back opens and it's the ghost, and then it quick just cuts into her face as she screams.
Yeah. Yeah, there is some, like, Ray Austin does some very fun work with this. It feels, you know, again, we are in that space between Event Horizon and Garth Marenghi's Dark Place.
Mm.
And when they're shaking plants to show psychic distress and bad things are happening, we're firmly on the Garth Marenghi side of it, but it's still done very well. You know, hell, we've seen shaky plants in the original Star Trek even. But yeah, it's like, okay, fine. You've set the tone. You've got the sitar not only at the concert at the start, but, you know, intermittently throughout as well.
It's the soundtrack for most of this episode. And that really helps set, like, the tone.
Definitely. And yeah, like, I didn't expect any of this. Like, I've tried to go in as ignorant as possible with Space 1999, because I think, as we've seen on this episode and the previous one that we did, that I had zero knowledge whatsoever about the show, and I just hope it continues being this bonkers.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's, I know there are some big shake-ups between the first and second series of it, but this is, like, this episode is one of those, like, I would show this one to people to go, this is what it is.
Yeah, like, I enjoyed the hell out of this one. There's some good camera work. The melty face makeup is pretty, I would say it's pretty graphic.
Yeah, I was quite pleased with the crispiness of all that, because it's a little vague. At first, I was like, oh, is there going to be some kind of plant version of Mateo that's shown up? Or, like, what is all of this? And when you get the initial silhouette, I'd quickly rewind, because I pretty much blinked and missed it. Like, is that him? Is that Mateo somehow? Like, is there some shadow self, or again, of the plants trying to communicate in some kind of the happening situation?
What? No. The fucking happening.
Yeah. I can't remember why I got round to watching it. I think it was one of those, you know, I've heard it's bad. I'm curious. I'm curious how bad.
It's pretty bad.
It is. Like, last year I ended up finally getting around to watching The Village, and it wasn't too bad.
The Village, right. The twist had been given away. I honestly think that Signs and The Village are very underrated. Like, I understand. The trouble is, like, the big complaint about Signs that, oh, the, why would the aliens invade a planet where water is lethal to them? It's like, yeah, like, it's a basic science fiction conceit. You know, yeah. It's like, you know, you take, like, the big twist of War of the Worlds, that the Martians get killed by the common cold. And you're like, yeah, that's kind of hokey, but it's, you know, it's not what the film was about. It's about Mel Gibson's character's faith.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like so many of these things, where you go, just because it's film doesn't mean it has to be 100% literal.
Yeah.
You know, oh God, what was it? I was watching something the other day where there were some questions about that, or of like, okay, in fact, it might have been about a comic of like, again, you can present things in a non-literal fashion in visual media, and it's fine, guys. It's all right. You know, just give us the vibes and we will play with it. And yeah, this episode is kind of perfect at doing that. We don't actually see a huge amount of the main cast. We see bits of, like, Koenig and Victor, of course, and Dr.
Yeah.
Russell. but this is mostly a ghost story featuring like Mateo, Laura, bit of Dr. Warren before he's quite quickly dispatched. And yeah, I'm curious to see if other paranormal things end up happening during this show now.
All right, so where do you want to put this on the space slate?
Well, I feel pretty confident that this is one of the best ones we've got on here.
All right, so
I guess it's that thing of, is this better than Brian Blessed and John Shrapnel's performances?
Oh, honestly, part of me is like, no. Because there is some amazing stuff in Death's Other Dominion, which isn't just Brian Blessed fucking melting. It is the very Shakespearean performances both the guest actors give.
When the quandary of do we do this? Like, is this actually something where we can stay there now?
Like, we get a little bit of Koenig going, this is weird, nope, don't like it.
Always love that. That's
at least here it feels a bit more justified because it does go into the supernatural.
Yeah. Okay. So another favorite just under it with Dragon's Domain with our spaceship graveyard and flashbacks to a weird tentacle monster that's been messing with folks. I mean, again, that is a nigh perfect episode.
Yeah.
In my eyes, at least. It's weird to go, yeah, the one with the tentacle monster that's got like a torch in it. But at the
same time, it's just like, what a goddamn visual image.
Hell yeah.
When the monster arrives and it's a screaming maw, and it's not just the monster screaming, it's also the sound of like, is that the sound of vacuum of space just being pulled out of the ship?
Oh god, that's so good. I love it so much. okay. It's very difficult because both are beautifully space horror in very different ways.
Yeah. I think this one might slightly beat out Dragon's Domain because as much as I love Dragon's Domain, I feel like the problem with the story is that it is half flashback.
Yeah, and you know, like the performances in this are so perfectly tuned to the story, to the ghosts, to all of it. I did have to look up, like, was this just Mateo's actor? He wasn't one of twins or anything. And yeah, it's like, okay, good. Yeah, good work with all this, because yeah, for something in 1976 to be pulling these kind of things and not looking hokey, it's good work. And you know, obviously the crusty face helps, but
the crusty face, the fact that like this show is pretty, you know, it's not low budget. And like, I love the fact that when we get to see something that is, you know, pretty decently budgeted with some very good directing and camera work, which helps give it a lot of energy. I think sometimes that's definitely one of the problems with Star Trek, is that it's very, for the most part, Star Trek is very kind of stagey television, so a lot of like, it never really goes in for like a really good visual, but just some fantastic some good acting where it is.
Oh yeah, has like sometimes. I think with Star Trek, it's that thing where sometimes you do get someone that plays with some nice visual aspects and go like, oh, right, okay, I'm sitting up and watching this. And, you know, I think Jonathan Frakes has done some good directing like that. But yeah, it's kind of still a slave to doing network TV turnovers for it all. This has definitely earned its number two rank. So
this is your second engagement with the world of Space 1999, and how are you feeling about it now that you've seen more?
I am excited to see more of it. I'm a little worried that all of the weird shit is being front-loaded here. but who knows? Hopefully there's just, you know, 48 episodes of weird shit in general with it. So, yeah, I'm curious to see what's next for the space scamps. But yes, that's, speaking of which, that is it for Space Scamps 2, The Scampening. Next time, we're going to be back to doing some Star Trek, and Miles introduced me to a Star Trek-type meme ages ago with Badmirals, or at least a trope with Badmirals, and we built an episode around that. And what new thing are you introducing me to this time?
Well, I am introducing to you to the con- well, I think actually I may have gotten it wrong, but it's the idea of a planet of hats, where we have a planet where every single part of the culture is basically a monoculture.
Oh, good. Yeah, after seeing so many episodes of people trying to get away from it, like Quark trying to be more than just the one type of person a Ferengi is, or anything like that. So yeah, it'll be interesting seeing what is basically the opposite of that, and see them playing up to, like, your weird monocultures.
Or maybe it'll just end up being an episode with some really nice fashion. You never know.
Yeah, that's good too.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, in the meantime, you can find us on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social. On Ko-fi, if you like what we do and want to throw us a bit of money, then that's ko-fi.com/casualtrek. And Miles, where can folks find you?
They can find me on Blue Sky at milesreedlibato.bsky.social. Or on my blog at mareedlibato.wordpress.com.
Excellent. And I can be found also over at Blue Sky on skyshark.bsky.social. Over on Faked Tales, where I continue my marathon of going through all of 2000 AD. And on Who Dares Roles, where I've recently reviewed the Star Trek Adventures role-playing game, if you miss me talking about Star Trek. So yeah, with that, I guess we're not telling them to live long and do a Starfleet and all that. I guess try not to go mad at the enormity and weirdness of space.
Don't be, if someone turns up with a free seat in their ship, don't be a dick and try and take it by force.
Yeah, and be nice to your future ghost. You don't know what they've been through yet.
And, you know, tell computer that you value their efforts.
Yeah.